Welcome to PageCast at Open Book Cape Town, a special edition of the regular podcast brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers. Usually, we explore the latest in literature year-round, but today, we're coming to you straight from the heart of the Open Book Festival, Cape Town's annual celebration of South African literature in an international context. In these festival-exclusive episodes, we sit down with some of the most inspiring voices in literature to delve into their stories, insights, and the powerful narratives that shape our world. Let's dive into the pages together. Lesedi Molefe joins us in this episode. Lesedi is a Soweto-born writer, documentary filmmaker, photographer, and entrepreneur. He has served as a writer and researcher for numerous broadcast documentaries, notably Lebogang Resetaba's popular MTV project The People vs. The People, award-winning documentary filmmaker Sifiso Kanyile's A New Country, as well as the writer and director for a docuseries Reconnecting Pangaea. Patient 12A is his first book. It was shortlisted for the prestigious City Press Tafelberg Nonfiction Award. Molefe lives and works in Johannesburg. Thanks so much for joining us, Lesedi, and welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, yes.
Can you tell us a bit more about Patient 12A, your first book?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I guess maybe the beginning. It's a good place. And in 2016, I was in a really strange place, and I was burnt out at work, something that I think a lot of people will feel familiar with. And more than that, I was also just kind of struggling to connect meaningfully with the people around me. Then decided to sort of admit myself. A friend of mine was like, yo, Lee, like, you don't look like you're so good. And he had just come out of the clinic. And he was like, I think maybe you should check this out. Maybe you should go see my doctor. So I did. I walked into the clinic and I was like, I'm going to be here for 7 days. And I remember thinking to myself also, like, it's a shame that some people have to be here for 21 days. I ended up staying for 24 days in the end. So joke was on me. I ended up staying because there was so much to uncover. I didn't realize there was so much to unpack about my deeply dysfunctional childhood, deeply dysfunctional and traumatic childhood. It's interesting that I didn't really think there was anything to unpack. You know, I think that's something we're not a very trauma-aware society. And I think that's something, you know, I think the fact that after such a traumatic childhood, I didn't really think there was anything to work through or to heal or to just kind of work on, I think is an accurate reflection of just how little we know about our mental health and, you know, how little we talk about it and how little we know about just kind of how trauma affects our ability to human at full capacity. And so this book is my exploration of my attempt at humaning at full capacity.
Patient 12A is an incredibly raw and honest memoir. What was the process like for you to revisit and share such personal and painful experiences? And how did writing this book contribute to your own journey of self-discovery and healing?
So, you know, I loved it, man. I loved it and I hated it, right? What I loved was that I never really get to share my past because it's so traumatic and most people can't really relate to it, right? It's like, people talk about high school and it's like, you know, they talk about things that are quite common and I can't really talk about such common experiences because I never even went to the same school for more than a year. People talk about early life in, you know, growing up in a particular town or city. I can't really do that because I never really stayed in the same city for more than a year in my early life. So we moved around a lot and yeah, it was pretty eventful start to life. And so, you know, to be able to finally kind of, you know, share myself completely, yeah, was deeply liberating. Also just kind of felt very free and also to do it in a way that I think feels so meaningful to me, in a way that kind of makes sense of things in a way that I guess can help others, feels really special to me. So that's the one side. And the second part is that it was painful. You know, it was deeply painful. It was very lonely. I mean, I spent about 6 years writing it, 2 years kind of on and off and 4 years in a proper hard slog. Yeah, I used to use like scents and sounds and smells and, you know, to kind of trigger memories and, you know, trigger moments. You know, I remember using Whitney Houston's music to kind of trigger memories of my mom. Right. So that was a big part of my process, and kind of writing at night also. Trying to sort of write in the stillness, trying to find some stillness, no disturbances, no easy distractions. And yeah, those are some of them. Yeah, that was kind of a big part of my process. I don't know if you have any more specific questions about the process, but for me, a big part of my, I guess, struggles were shame, shame about kind of how my life had been, how it had turned out. And so being able to write this book also is like, my response to that shame, and it's sort of me, it feels like me reclaiming myself in so many ways, and just kind of being able to walk out into the world and say, this is who I am. I think that's a very important part of anybody's mental health journey, is sort of being able to sort of reclaim your body, your mind, and yeah, your identity in some ways. And so it's been very beneficial for my mental health in that sense. I hid so much in my life for so long, pretty much all the time, pretty much every single day. And so to finally be able to just come out to the world as who I am feels great.
I mean, you touch on the challenges of discussing mental illness within Black families specifically. What are some of the specific cultural barriers you faced in having these conversations? And how do you hope your book will contribute to breaking the stigma surrounding mental health in these communities?
Sure. I mean, I mentioned that it's difficult to talk about mental health in Black families because I obviously come from a Black family, but I think that's true for most families
Definitely.
everywhere in the world, any of any race, of any background, class or otherwise. It's a very, very difficult conversation to have. And so in my particular case, so my mom struggled with her mental health a lot. In fact, essentially what I'm doing in the book is I'm working through surviving my childhood that my mom was essentially kind of the driver of. And a big part of the book is about kind of living with a parent who struggles with their mental with a mental illness, or just just kind of has mental health struggles broadly. And there's kind of a lot of myths and sort of misconceptions about mental illness, mental health, that kind of circulate quite easily. Like, people would be like, just pray about it, people would be like, it's an ancestral calling, it's time to be a sangoma, so people, there's just, or, like witchcraft, people just kind of be like, you're cursed, or maybe the ancestors are angry at you. And I'm not saying that that might not be true, I don't know. But I think it gets in the way sometimes of kind of allowing many things to be true at once, when people so strictly stick to a particular definition or another. And so, yeah, there's a lot of kind of, sort of like superstitious, kind of ideas around mental health and mental illness. And for me, I think a big part of breaking the stigma is making a clear, or showing a clear connection between our material conditions and our mental health. I think, or even like kind of breaking the myths that surround sort of the mental health conversation in the Black community, is clearly showing how crucial our material conditions are to our mental health, right? So, people kind of don't see how, when I walked into the clinic for the first time, what was interesting to me was that, like, the first thing I saw was just like this cross section of ordinary South Africans that were just kind of working through life, or trying to survive the trauma as living as an everyday, South African. I think a lot of the time we don't realize how traumatic life can be in this country, and I guess generally, but also, people go through a lot in this country, right? Like, on so many levels. And we often, I don't think we talk enough about how traumatic survival is. We often hero and celebrate resilience, but we don't talk about the trauma involved in being resilient. And actually, we don't talk about how the, the fact that resilience is so necessary is quite alarming. You know, the fact that such an extreme level of resilience is necessary just to get by.
Yeah, everyone always says how resilient South Africans are.
Yeah.
And I think all of us always think it's such a good thing,
right,
which in some ways it might be.
Sure.
But it's exactly what you're saying. To get there, we go through trauma.
Huge amounts.
Because how do you become resilient?
Precisely. And, you know, so, I mean, and that's such a great point you're making, because for me, you know, that resilience was a key factor in my depression, right? Because in order to survive my daily conditions, I had to suppress my emotions, right? And that's what depression is, right? You are literally pushing down and kind of batting away feelings that it's not safe to feel in the moment. So, you know, a big part of my experience was, don't feel right now. It's not safe to feel right now. As a child, I learned quite quickly that, you know, it wasn't conducive to our survival to feel. Feelings are inconvenient. Feelings are going to get in the way. Feelings are... Basically, I became a child that had to be an adult quite quickly, right? And yeah, so a lot of South Africans do that. We think we're being resilient by suppressing ourselves, by ignoring how we really feel about things. And it's actually, if you don't allow some time for compassion and self-inquiry, it can manifest into something quite painful and influence your mental health in a quite painful way, as I experienced.
No, definitely. And I mean, you touched now on your time in the clinic.
Yeah.
It's obviously central to the book that you wrote. What were some of the most surprising or challenging aspects of this experience for you, and how did it shape your understanding of mental health treatment?
What were some of the most challenging and surprising parts?
Yes, of the experience.
I think something that's quite challenging, I think for anybody who might walk into there, and it certainly was for me, is the internalized stigma. You know, you'd be surprised, you know, I thought I was pretty progressive and aware, and, you know, but no, I walked in and I actually had a lot of internalized stigma about mental illness and mental health that I hadn't really made kind of conscious. And that's a big part of why it's written in such a personal way, is because I wanted to kind of also represent my missteps and my mistakes as well along the process of growth, right? Along the journey, I just wanted it to kind of feel, you know, as opposed to 12 steps, you know, so sort of like a strict 12-step program, you know, for me it was like 13 missteps that I took along my mental health journey. I think that's really important, A, to break with the stigma around sort of, you know, people feeling like they need to perform their health, or they need to perform their healing. Don't. and I think being in the clinic, which, you know, to move on to something that was surprising, being in the clinic allowed for that, right? In such a surprising way. Like I said earlier, you know, sometimes it felt like school, right? Because it's just like we all leave a class. So there were like these sort of daily classes, like I think 4 or 5 classes a day. And it's like anything from negative self-talk, a session called Who Am I? You know, a session called DBT Education, a session focused on anxiety, where we really get a full mental health education. And we also kind of learn tools about how to cope with triggers and sort of, you know, in the world out there and in real life situations. And, you know, surprisingly for me, like it was just, there was this courtyard. We had this courtyard where we just kind of all sat there and chain smoked all day. And, you know, it was like between classes, we just go out like and have a cigarette and after lunch, we call it a post-chow why. It was just such an interesting environment to be in, because so much of the healing, so much of the growth process, so much of the journey happens alongside other patients as opposed to your therapist, right? And for me, there's a lot of insight in that, in the sense that community is so essential to positive mental health balance. it's crucial, like, you know, being with people that can affirm you, who can affirm each other, who can listen to each other patiently, because we have nowhere to go, you know, because we're not rushing off to the next meeting, and we can practice community in such a meaningful way in a space like that. Those are some of the things that for me are so interesting and so human that I wanted Patient Tove to explore, things that we can maybe think about in our everyday life, you know, at home. You know, like, how much time do we really give each other? Not to chain smoke, but how much time do we really give each other to just kind of sit there together and just kind of talk? It's wonderful just how much that contributed to my own healing. And that was surprising. And the last thing?
I just said, how did this sort of your experience shape your understanding of mental health treatment?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, there's some wonderful researchers and thinkers on mental health treatment, particularly decolonial mental health treatment and decolonial mental health thinkers, like Dr. Kopano Radele, for example, that I'm just so keen to learn from. You know, I remember having a conversation with a friend, and he was like, you know, it's kind of weird to call it post-traumatic stress disorder for someone living in South Africa and maybe sort of, you know, someone in the position that I am in or that we are in, because, you know, there's almost certainly nothing post about it, right? You're always anticipating the very next trauma you're living in, and that's really anxiety, right? But there is also, I think, something just to be said around, like, the language that we use around mental health treatment that maybe should be sort of like more locally, more locally placed, I guess. Yeah, I think there's a lot around sort of the language we use around mental health that we can kind of develop for South African reality, for an African reality, for post-colonial reality, a post-apartheid reality, that I'm excited around, you know, that I'm so excited to see so many amazing researchers sort of carry out.
The theme of filtering out the noise in your head to find the truth is powerful in your book. How did you navigate the chaos in your mind to arrive at the truths that you share in the book? And what message do you hope readers will take away from your journey?
Man, did I separate the noise? I don't know, man. You know, so, I mean, if you look at the cover, you know, I tried to show as much respect to the noise as I showed to, you know, kind of the coherent thinking, the coherent thoughts, you know, and for me, like, both are important. I think, you know, something that, you know, actually I haven't really spoken about a lot, not even on stage here at Open Book, right, is, you know, my idea that, you know, like, on many levels, mental illness and depression are right. And it's a clumsy way to put it. If there's noise, it means there's parts of you that are really tussling and struggling to be heard, that are not being heard. If you believe that the world as we know it today is normal, then anybody whose body resists the world as we know it today will be thought of as abnormal. But if you kind of can recognize or even mildly suspect that the world as it is today is not normal, then you might start to listen to the people whose bodies resist the world as we know it today. And you might start to show some appreciation for that noise, because they try to imagine themselves out of the reality as we know it. And I did that too, you know, like, I think especially for a child's mind, you know, when you're in such a traumatic reality, you know, children imagine themselves outside of it, you know, and you kind of let your imagination take you elsewhere. And I think as we become adults, sometimes we suppress that also, you know, we suppress that instinct to kind of see outside of what we think of as normal. And there's really no such thing. And so I have a lot of respect for the noise now.
And are you working on anything new already? What's next for you?
Yeah, man, absolutely. I mean, I would love to continue, I think, the work that I hope Patient Suave sets a strong kind of precedent for. The intention of 2025 is to kind of run very small sort of consultancy or creative consultancy where we would write, ghostwrite, make documentaries, online content, all kinds of things around difficult conversations. I really enjoy difficult conversations. So, you know, I want to kind of be a specialist in awkward conversations.
Wow.
I want to be a specialist in like difficult conversations. And so that's the work I hope to carry out for the next few years of my life. It's just kind of, also other people's stories, you know, find ways to tell those stories, documentaries, podcasts, hopefully, if you guys invite me back and you show me how this works.
You're definitely invited back.
Thank you. But yeah, man, I think, I'm really looking forward to producing a lot of content around the things we don't want to talk about.
All right. I think we'll end off this episode with a reading. If you'd be so kind as to read us a bit from your book.
Sure. So it's called, so what happened is that at the clinic we had this, like I said earlier, it's like school periods sometimes, you know, it's just like we had this class and it was projectives, you know, where you wrote letters to your past self, you wrote a letter to your present self and a letter to your future self. And this is quite late in the book. So, you know, for anybody listening who hasn't read the book, sorry for the spoiler. It comes from a place of love, I swear. This one was the letter to my future self. Writing this letter to you implies that the future might be deeper than the past. It implies that you will grow past this. It implies that you can write your own future, teasing out a genre your life will hopefully take on. You've learned that the steering doesn't win the girl at the end for being a good person. You've learned that being a good person is not something you can earn, nor should you try to. No, you'll realize you're an inevitable contradiction of everything you have been. To imagine yourself at 50 years old is a contradiction of the 25-year-old you are today. That's how you will know that this worked, that you grew up, that you changed your mind. That's how you will know that the hand that reached for the mask at 25 has revealed itself and it's yours. That's how you will know that you've defeated the noise. But if the noise is a song sung by all the different people you could have been, the parts you fear, the parts of you that excite other people or the missed opportunity you sense, what if you sing a small part of that song? You could ask yourself for things. Things like self-respect and yourself back, for softness, grace for grieving, forgiveness for failure, mercy for not saving Ma, the hubris to feel difficult emotions, hold difficult opinions about yourself and allow yourself to come out on the other side of them. It will take the effort of your best traits to live in the company of your worst traits. Perhaps if you could untense your body to allow your energy to flow freely and to surprise yourself with the sensations it returns. You could ask for the trust to allow yourself to experience power. Trust is not a privilege, after all, it's a gift. It's the right to decide a common destiny. But it's also the right to not know and to pursue knowledge, to tell more of the truth, to move ahead with your life, daring to learn new things and feel new feelings, to be patient with yourself. Give yourself a shot at feeling loved by others. You'll learn to stop talking to keep a thought from occurring. Stop punishing yourself remorselessly. You'll learn to live for yourself, to be selfish. Observe your own mind and your interest in others. You'll learn to not play a role in a set, cast, but improvise. You might look back and find these requests fearful and poor, but here's the gift you all have given yourself, a strange education. You've gained a strange education from the nothing. Define it, the thing you want to do. Be the cycle breaker Ma raised you to be. Learn to listen to your body and not betray it. Learn to not betray your own mind and sensations for the comfort of others. Cry. These are the lessons of your strange education. Don't let shame talk you out of seeing. When you live inside shame, everything is ugly, embarrassing, treacherous, inadequate, useless, and not worth the trouble. You must allow yourself to taste possibility, to see. Don't be embarrassed of your past and of yourself. Don't attack yourself or hurt yourself as an act of sacrifice, the falsest form of love. Stop fearing that the rage, anger, and pain in your body will betray you. Allow yourself to switch off, to just be. Can you accept the facts of your life? Don't argue with them. Just be there with them. Don't question them and wonder why they are not different. Just be there with them. Can you do that? You have the right to be selfish and live entirely for yourself and your convictions, even if they're wrong. Embrace the concept of healthy discrimination. and you'll know what it's like, you said, to honor yourself and your needs before thinking about anyone else's. You have the God-given right to do that, free will, and you have the right to not be punished for doing that. Find some self-respect and kindness for the parts of you that are still learning. Allow your personality to splutter to a start for the leaves to fall and grow again. You will do things you don't want to do, things you don't know how to do, and things you have always wanted to do. Remember that feelings don't need to be fixed, only to be felt. It's okay. Don't deal with the emotion. Just feel it without reacting to it. See what it tells you. Give it a voice. Learn its personality and why it's come to visit. Learn new feelings. This will create some space within where old hurts used to be. Real, new, and immediately stimulating feelings will begin to emerge. Don't try to stop them. You will have a lot of free space, and when the noise quietens, you may not know what to do with all the clarity. But if you stop persecuting yourself and your own thoughts, this clearing might reveal a friend. Don't be weighed down by others and what they expect from you. I don't know how you're going to pull it off, but you will. Fear yourself less, fear them no more. You will make mistakes, embrace that fact. Go into it gently and don't let anyone shame you for the choices and mistakes you will make. Also allow yourself to recharge after every social interaction. Take 8 months if you have to. You're good. You remember that you're still a good person and the worst parts of you deserve the most love. Experience the mystery of yourself. Who do you think you are and how soon were you contradicted? You've been many people all at once. You're not even the same person you were when you got to the clinic. You learn a lot of weird shit as you go, like the fact that spiders sing. There will be a rough draft of Lesedi, then there will be Lesedi_new_final, followed by Lesedi_final_final, and Lesedi_fucking_final, and maybe a last-ditch final_for_fucking_real. Every version will be a part of you. A work in progress, not something you need to control. It's something you will grow into. I want you to be patient with yourself as you move through these changes. So we get up being yourself, you're going to be bad at being yourself. You have to be bad at being authentic in order to be authentic. Be good at practice. You will get overwhelmed, but you'll want to stay grounded in the moment. You can learn new habits while holding yourself accountable and forgiving yourself for old habits. You'll experience stressful thoughts and sensations as you begin to feel your own body, but you'll keep moving forward and allowing yourself to be supported blood. In relationships, the ask is simple. Stay close to the people that help you feel more connected to yourself and won't shame you for what emerges. Stop explaining yourself to people that make you miserable and remind you of the worst parts of yourself. You know who they are. Keep it real. Try to be happy, not right.
Thank you so much
for
sharing that with us. And thanks so much for joining us on the episode today.
This is fun.
All the best for the festival.
Thank you so much.
Hope it all goes well.
Yeah, it's been a good time.
Thank you for joining us on this special edition of PageCast at Open Book Cape Town. Stay tuned for more conversations with incredible authors. And remember, every story brings us closer to understanding the world around us. Until next time, keep turning those pages.